Israel's attack on its consular building in Syria, calling for an urgent meeting on the regime's violation. And Israel's indiscriminate strikes kill several foreign aid workers in Gaza as a death toll from the regime's genocide nears 32,850, mostly women and children. Hello and welcome to World News, everyone. Now, several people have been killed in an Israeli airstrike targeting the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus, Syria. The attack took place right next to a building, which was the embassy. It's also residence of the Iranian ambassador at the Mazar neighborhood of central Damascus. The ambassador and his family were not harmed, but this is the second Israeli attack targeting the vicinity in a day. On Sunday, Israeli forces targeted another part of the capital, Damascus, with rockets launched from the occupied Golan Heights. Ibrahim Wati, our correspondent in Damascus earlier, joined us from the scene of the Israeli attack for more details.
At 5 p.m. today, the Israeli enemy launched an air attack that targeted the Iranian consulate in a blatant violation of international laws and human norms. The aggression resulted in the destruction of the four-story building right behind me completely. Ambulances, firefighting team, civil defense team all rushed to the place. They start digging for survivors. Also, there has been reports that The Brigadier General Sayyid Mohammad Reza Zahidi was martyred, which is a senior IRGC commander in Al-Quds Force. We have heard lately that there has been condemnation by several countries. First, the Iranian foreign minister condemned this attack and considered Netanyahu a maniac, a madman who wants war through this provocation. The Syrian foreign ministry also condemned this attack, and the Syrian foreign minister, Dr. Faisal Maqdad, came to the location and checked on the ambassador and his family, which was fine. He was at his office doing his work, doing his job when the attack happened, but thankfully he was fine. The Dr. Faisal Maqdad said that Syria is standing firmly with Iran, and this attack will never intimidate us. We condemn this attack and consider it a violation of the sovereignty of Syria, also as well Iran. The Ministry of the Russian Ministry of Defense also condemned this attack and consider it a dangerous escalation that may lead to an open war in the region. They condemned the attack as well. Palestinian factions, the Palestinian Front for Struggle, several Palestinian leaders as well.
Islamic Revolution Guard Corps says Israel's attack on Iran's consular mission in Damascus is out of desperation caused by irreparable defeat it's recently suffered. IRGC said the Palestinians in Gaza and resistance in the region have dealt heavy blows to Israel. It also confirmed seven Iranian military advisors, including two senior commanders, were killed. Regional resistance groups have also condemned this attack, with Hamas calling it a dangerous escalation and blatant violation of Iran and Syria's sovereignty. Palestinian Islamic Jihad described it as a cowardly act, and Lebanon's Hezbollah vowed Israel's crime will not go unpunished. Also, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine also stressed the attack could not have happened without a green light from the U.S. Several countries, including Pakistan, Oman, Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Russia, also denounced Israeli aggression as unacceptable. Hossein Akhmedi, Iran's ambassador to Syria, has vowed the Islamic Republic will give a decisive response to Israel's attack on its consulate.
Two of the police forces of the Syrian government also got wounded in the operation. They were taken to a hospital. A number of cars were set ablaze. Part of the walls and premises, the main premise of the building of the embassy collapsed. The Zionist crime is nothing surprising. For more than 6 months, the Zionists are committing any kinds of crimes. They can't commit crimes against children, women in Gaza and the West Bank and Lebanon, even in Syria and elsewhere in the world. And insanely, Netanyahu is like a lone rider just committing crimes to protect himself in his position. And advocates of the Zionist regime, the U.S. and others, are also kind of complicit in these crimes. The Islamic Republic of Iran so far has stood against all these crimes, all this violence, and will definitely give the right response, as it has already given the right responses. The difference is that this time, maybe for the first time, the Zionist regime has allowed itself to hit an official building, the embassy premises of Iran, where the flag of the Islamic Republic is hoisted atop it. So this is the difference in this attack this time, and that's the crime that the Zionists have admitted to having committed. So this is the job of the international circle and those of the advocates of the Zionist regime. They need to be accountable. So the Islamic Republic of Iran, too, will reciprocate and in due time will take the right action.
The Iranian foreign minister has called for an immediate and appropriate response by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation to the Israeli terrorist attack on its on the Iranian consular mission in Damascus. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the call in a phone conversation with the OIC Secretary General. The Iranian foreign minister said the attack violates all international laws. For his part, Hossein Brahim Taha pointed to Israel's criminal history and strongly condemned the strikes. Iran's also called on the UN Security Council to condemn this attack in the strongest possible terms and hold an urgent meeting to address the violation. Iran's foreign ministry also summoned the Swiss ambassador, which represents U.S. interests in Tehran. Amir Abdullahian said an important message was relayed to Washington as a main supporter of the Israeli regime. He said the U.S. must answer for this crime. Scores more Palestinians are killed in Gaza's U.S.-Israeli campaign of genocide approaches the grim six-month milestone. In the central city of Deir al-Balah, Israeli forces targeted a vehicle owned by food aid agency World Central Kitchen. Four foreign aid workers and their Palestinian driver were all killed. The Hamas resistance movement strongly condemned the attack as part of Israel's policy of systematically killing unarmed civilians and international relief teams. Elsewhere in Deir al-Balah, the regime bombed a mosque which claimed the life of a child and injured 20 other people. To the south of the strip, Israeli bombardment and shelling of Rafah and Khan Yunis claimed more than a dozen civilian lives. Now, since the beginning of this campaign of genocide on October the 7th, more than 32,800 Gazans have been killed and nearly 75,000 injured. Iraqi anti-terror group says it's ready to send military supplies to fellow resistance fighters in Jordan to help defend Palestinians against Israeli atrocities. Qatayb Hezbollah says it's prepared supplies for over 12,000 fighters. It said provisions include light weaponry, anti-armor launchers, tactical missiles, ammunition, and explosives. The resistance group said it seeks to form a united front against Israel. Qatayb Hezbollah also voiced readiness to block land routes leading to Israeli-occupied territories if it receives a go-ahead from Palestinian movements. Qatayb Hezbollah also carried out multiple military operations against Israel and the U.S. since the beginning of the Gaza onslaught. Back in January, at least three U.S. forces were killed in one such attack on a military base belonging to the U.S. in Jordan. Housing prices throughout the West have gotten so high that many people have given up on the idea of ever owning a home. In Europe, protests are being held to demand more government intervention on the issue of building more affordable housing. Rabbi Mazahiri has your story out of Paris.
In a statistic which may amaze and anger those in their 20s and 30s, in 1973, the average French person dedicated just 10% of their income to housing. In places like Lisbon, that figure is now 63%, as the housing situation across Europe is being called the worst it has been in 70 years. With winter prohibitions on evictions ending with the arrival of spring, protests are being held across Europe against the lack of affordable housing.
Houses are made for living in, and not for financial speculation. This is a fundamental truth which has been forgotten by successive French governments. They have turned their back on the many victims of our long-running housing crisis, and across Europe it's the same. What's worse is that they'll have many people evicted by landlords looking to cash out on tourist money for the Summer Olympics.
One out of four French people suffer from a serious housing problem, so it's no surprise that better housing has been a top issue for voters in election after election.
There's a real lack of decent, new, and safe housing in France and Europe, as much of our stock dates from after World War II. The laws requiring that 20% of lodgings be made available to lower-income citizens is not enforced, and we just don't see that the government cares about the incredible difficulty of finding affordable housing here in France.
In Paris, housing prices are up a back-breaking 70% since 2009, the start of the great financial crisis, and the failed response of far-right economic austerity. The hiking of interest rates in 2022 caused some housing markets in Europe to decline slightly, but others continued to rise. That also caused building costs to soar, reducing private construction. Housing groups insist that lodging issues could be fixed nationwide in just 5 to 10 years if the government's laws favored renters and regular citizens instead of landowners and real estate speculators. The primary culprit seems to lie in the refusal of right-wing economics to allow governments to invest tax revenue in building more affordable real estate, and also in the vast sell-offs to private corporations of government housing since the 1980s. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iranians have marked the second of three Leilat al-Qadr nights. The religious occasion traditionally celebrates the revelation of the Holy Quran to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. However, with the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza, this year, praying for the liberation of Palestine has become the main theme of the ceremonies. Yusuf Misha Ahmadi reports from Tehran.
Reciting along with the Joshana Kabir prayer, calling on God by the 1001 names and attributes mentioned in this powerful prayer, and tearing up while asking God for redemption on one of the most sacred nights for Muslims, Laylatul Qadr, also referred to as the Night of Power or the Night of Destiny. In Iran, people traditionally gather in holy sites and mosques and keep a vigil on this occasion, which is observed on the nights before the 19th, the 21st, and the 23rd of the holy month of Ramadan. This year, however, like many other occasions over the past 6 months, the genocidal war on Gaza dominates the ceremony.
Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem is profoundly revered for us Muslims because of the significance of Laylatul Mi'raj, commemorating Prophet Muhammad's miraculous overnight ascension to heaven.
It's Qadr tonight. I'm praying for God for the liberation of Palestine and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Qadr night is one of the most sacred nights in Islam, and I come here every year to pray. But this year, all I want is for the atrocities against Palestinians to stop.
Performing religious rituals in a free Al-Aqsa Mosque and in a free Jerusalem is a wish that Iranians always pray for. But this time around, these prayers are mostly dedicated to the liberation of Palestine from Zionists and an end to the genocidal war on Gaza.
What's happening in Gaza right now is absolutely heartbreaking. That's why tonight we are praying for our Muslim brothers and sisters in Palestine. We are all praying to God for the defeat of Zionists and the victory of Palestinians.
And what better occasion than Qadr night? A night which is known to be the night when the destiny of every person is determined by God.
Qadr night in Islamic scriptures marks the night when the Holy Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. According to the Holy Quran, this night is better than 1,000 months. Our destiny is determined, and we pray that we can keep serving God.
Serving God by serving God's people on a night dedicated to good deeds. This is the best night for charitable activities as well, and everyone who is present here wants to make the best of it.
Laylatul Qadr, which is also referred to as the Night of Power or the Night of Destiny, is considered one of the most sacred occasions in the Islamic calendar, one that Muslims try not to miss. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye for now.
In the Limelight.
Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have been subjected to a constant saga of the Zionist regime slaughter and land grabs since October 7, 2023. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Israeli occupation forces demolished nearly 460 Palestinian homes last year, 2023, leaving more than 1,000 children without a safe home. This figure does not include other structures belonging to Palestinians destroyed by Israeli regime authorities. Now, the Zionist regime is accelerating land theft in the occupied West Bank, conducting assassinations of resistance fighters and killing children across the territory, despite repeated warnings that continued Israeli aggression would bring about an eruption. The Zionist regime approved the seizure of one of the largest chunks of land since the Oslo Accords were signed by Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization in mid-1990s. Bezalel Smotrich, the ultra-far-right Israeli regime finance minister, declared nearly 2,000 acres of Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank as so-called state lands. Smotrich claimed last week, "We are promoting settlement through hard work and in a strategic manner all over the country." The announcement was made on the eve of the arrival of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in the occupied territories. The Zionist settlement watchdog Peace Now said, "The size of the area designated for declaration is the largest since the Oslo Accords." The group added, "The year 2024 marks a peak in the extent of declarations of a state land." Declaring Palestinian land as a state land is a legal maneuver aimed at confiscating land belonging to Palestinians by interpreting an Ottoman law that was utilized in a completely different context nearly two centuries ago. This legal tactic enables the Zionist regime to circumvent the technical legality of land ownership, as most privately owned land in the West Bank is not officially registered, Peace Now said. This declaration follows the U.S. imposing token sanctions on three additional Jewish Israeli settlers earlier this month. This is in addition to the four settlers sanctioned by the U.S. last month in an apparent attempt to divert attention from its complicity in Israel's genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. Other countries, including France and the UK, followed suit. These sanctions falsely convey the impression that settler violence is caused by a few bad apples and sidestep the reality that the Zionist regime's illegal state-directed policy of settler colonization is inherently violent. The settlers are not acting as individuals but on behalf of the regime, whose goal is the theft and total control of all the land in the West Bank. The Zionist regime has escalated its lethal attacks across the occupied West Bank under the guise of targeting emerging armed resistance. Israeli regime troops invaded the Nur Shams refugee camp on March 20 and killed four Palestinians, including two children. Dozens of Israeli armored vehicles, including bulldozers, raided the camp east of Tul Karm city in the northern occupied West Bank and began bulldozing roads and underground infrastructure in the camp. The Zionist regime army does this under the pretext of an increase in makeshift explosives planted beneath roads to target invading Israeli armored vehicles. We are seeing IEDs in Beit Lahm, in Al-Khalil, contributing editor John Elmer recently said. From the southern tip of the West Bank to the northern tip of the West Bank, armed struggle, qualitative increase in armed struggle, unquote. The Zionist regime troops caused extensive damage to the Nur Shams refugee camp's infrastructure, including the complete destruction of the square adjacent to the camp's main entrance. Israeli regime forces also damaged public and private Palestinian property in the camp, as reported by Wafa News Agency. Pictures circulated by local media show uprooted roads around the refugee camp, causing massive destruction to roads in commercial and residential areas. An Israeli drone-fired missile killed two Palestinians, including a teenage child, as Israeli regime troops invaded the camp. Iyad Nidal Kanu, 17 years old, and another Palestinian man, Nidal Mamun Abu Obeid, were killed in the strike. The Zionist regime then deliberately delayed the Palestinian ambulance access to them for 2.5 hours, according to a field report by Defense for Children International Palestine. Israeli regime forces fatally wounded another Palestinian child in a camp by shooting him in the head hours later. Abdullah Mahmoud Qaisi, 17, was allegedly participating in confrontations against Israeli regime invaders in the refugee camp when the Zionist regime troops shot him from a distance of 50 to 60 meters, then prevented ambulances from reaching him. And another injured man, DCIP added. Palestinians transferred Abdullah and the other man to a nearby mosque for hours until Israeli regime forces withdrew from the area and they were transferred to a nearby hospital. Also on March 20, an Israeli drone-fired missile struck a vehicle in the Jenin refugee camp, killing four Palestinians. The Jenin Brigade, a group associated with Saray al-Quds, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad Resistance Group, identified the victims as Ahmad Barakat, leader of military operations, Ziad Hamran, who shot and injured members of the Zionist regime's domestic spy apparatus, the Shin Bet, at the Gush Etzion junction near Beit Lahm earlier this month, as well as members Mahmoud Rihal and Mohammad Al-Fayed. During the funeral procession of the four men, Palestinians demanded that the Palestinian Authority release the abductees affiliated with the Jenin Brigade to allow them to bid farewell to their comrades before burial. The PA violently suppressed the protest by firing tear gas canisters at funeral attendees, resulting in injuries to four people, one of whom sustained a head injury. Meanwhile, a Palestinian man accused of collaborating with Israeli regime authorities was killed in the Jenin refugee camp on March 21st. The Zionist regime fire killed 32 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank this year, 2024, including two U.S. citizens. Ayad Abu Ertiash of DCIP said, Israeli forces' non-stop brutality is facilitated by Western countries, especially the United States, which continue offering the Israeli government unconditional support and sending weapons to the Israeli military, which are used to kill Palestinian children without consequence. When the Zionist regime fire is not killing Palestinian children in the West Bank, it is also leaving them paralyzed. In February, a Palestinian teenager was riding an electric bike with another man when an Israeli regime military vehicle rammed into them, knocking them to the ground. The young man managed to flee while an Israeli troop struck 17-year-old Amr Shaydan with armored vehicle's door as he tried to stand up. An Israeli regime troop then shot Amr from point-blank range while he was already on the ground. As Amr lay bleeding, DCIP reported, one of the troops placed his hand on Amr's wound and shouted, "Die! Die!" Amr was eventually transferred to the hospital, where it was determined that the bullet fractured the cervical vertebrae in his neck, leading to spinal cord and paralysis of all four of the child's limbs. Dear listeners, this is the second part of A Window to Palestine.
Bien, ya estamos de vuelta y para retomar nuestras conversaciones.
Well, we are back. Let's continue our conversation with the Palestinian diaspora. Today, we have invited someone who is very special to me. We have known each other for many years, and we have worked together for many years. He is an actor and a social communicator. He has had radio programs and has radio programs today. Many years ago, he produced Palestine Forever. He is Cesar Agüeda. Some of you may have seen us more than once on the Sin Makwayaje program. How are you, Cesar? Thank you very much for accepting the invitation.
I also thank you for inviting me.
Cesar Agüeda nació en Chile.
Cesar Agüeda was born in Chile. He's an actor and radio coordinator with a long experience in both professions. His father arrived in Chile in 1950 looking for opportunities and to reunite with part of the family that had immigrated in 1920. She found him and also the woman who became his wife later. Cesar says that in his family, Arabic was always spoken and stories from his native land were recurrent. However, what connected him with his Palestinianness was not these, but his son, who was also born in Chile and visited Palestine at 13 for the first time. His only son decided to contribute to the cause of his people, and he returned to serve, work, and live in the land of his grandparents. Cesar has returned to Palestine twice and was able to see the house that his father had built. The joy of returning was always tinged with sadness and helplessness in the face of the abusive treatment of the occupying army. His deep commitment to the Palestinian cause has a double reason, his parents and grandparents, and now his son.
Y ahora, la causa de su hijo.
I know, Cesar, that your family, your father, arrived in the 50s after the Nakba.
Exactly.
And that indeed he married your mother here, and you were born in a context that was surely the beginning of the entire Palestinian diaspora. The denial, the fact that you want to leave everything behind and forget everything. This is a little similar to my family. They passed on to us little of the cause and the Palestinian sentiment. So in your case, and in the case of my parents, how was the whole thing? I somewhat know the answer, that after skipping a generation, the Palestinian cause break into the family again with the force that broke into yours.
La causa palestina volviera a irrumpir en la familia con la fuerza que irrumpió en la tuya.
Let's see. For me, it was surprising in the first place, because until many years ago, I thought that even my family was from Jordan. Jordan was confused with Palestine. This guy, what was his name? Oh, Anwar al-Sadat. I even thought he was the president of Palestine, but no, he was not from Palestine. He made a whole mess. Of course, my parents always spoke Arabic all day at home, all day long, and they talked about everything. I didn't understand anything. I know 4 or 5 words, but with my son, things changed. With my son, things changed because of the relationship between dad and son. And I'm also going to give myself some credit because, you know, this shirt is not a coincidence. When curiously, I was also away as a football fan, but Elias Figueras, a Palestinian, returned as a coach in late 1994, and I said, no, I have to come back to the stadium if Elias Figueras is mine. We started with Javier, my son. Javier was 9 years old. We started there. Then he traveled with my father to Palestine. My father returned to Palestine 2-3 times, and he went with him when he was 12, 13 years old, and it was too strong for him.
Life changed there with Javier.
Absolutely. Javier was clear that he was going to go to Palestine.
I mean, your father did with his grandson.
What didn't happen to me?
What he didn't do with his son.
Yeah, kind of. Or what his son didn't want him to do.
Javier, your son, returned to Palestine before you.
Much earlier, of course. I returned to Palestine at the age of 53, that is 10 years ago.
And you returned precisely to visit your son. This is one of the few cases that I know of, because in the diaspora, many always talk about the right of return, but there are only a few who would think of actually returning, and your son did it, and that made you return to Palestine.
Exactly.
¿Cuál fue la impresión?
How does it feel to return to a place where you had never been?
It happened to me. And there, I want to go to your book, Palestine, Chronicle of a Siege, which you wrote in 2013. It's the same feeling that you write about in your book. It's like it's always been there. Joy. It was very pleasant. You understand me. And as you also say in the book, to rise up in Palestine is to resist. And I saw this directly.
How did you see the Israeli occupation affecting the possibility of what in this part of the world is called entrepreneurship? How does it affect economic development? I had a very hard experience on the first trip when I went to see the Wall of Infamy, the Wall of Segregation, which is an illegal wall declared by the International Court of Justice. This wall is in the section that crosses Bethlehem, in the boulevard, that is, a tremendously rich, prosperous commercial area full of commercial premises.
In the middle.
In the middle and 2 meters from the stores, those stores never opened again. They never had a customer again, exactly as you saw.
Terrible, Daniel, terrible. But one thing surprises me. I remember I visited a stadium in Ramal, a football stadium built by FIFA. Believe me, Daniel, the wall is too close, 1 meter from the field. I mean, it's too close that if the ball is thrown out of the stadium, it hits the wall. Do you understand what I'm saying? Terrible, terrible. And it surprises me because Palestinians have obstacles every day, like the one you describe. I'm surprised by the joy of the Palestinian people. The occupation, the Israeli Zionist crime, has not won the joy of the Palestinian people. You must have experienced the same thing I saw in all the places I visited. The hugs, the coffee. It is wonderful how the Palestinian people have joy. I don't know. I'm asking you, Daniel. How do you explain this?
Well, it's resilience we need to remember. I always mention this point in all my programs. Palestine is a land whose people have had to resist throughout more than 7,000 years of history, invasion after invasion, only having 127 years of peace in its entire history. Therefore, it is imaginable that the Palestinians who were there before the first invaders arrived, who will surely be there after the last ones leave, are used to it. In these successive blows of life, others who are not from this land argue that the control and possession of this territory is so important for the history of humanity. The Palestinian nation has learned to live, to reproduce their existence, and to deliver the fruit of their work to the rest of humanity under those conditions. The last time you lived in Palestine was 2015, when this process of increasing pressure on Gaza had already begun, and the objective was to usurp Gaza at some point and make Palestinian people disappear from there. Did you have the opportunity to visit Gaza?
Al pueblo palestino de ahí. ¿Tuviste la oportunidad de visitar Gaza?
Llegué a la puerta de Gaza.
I arrived at the gate of Gaza. I had traveled there with my nephew. It was a brutal experience. At that time, my nephew was 20 years old, and he had to undergo 3 to 4 hours of interrogation. I walked around, looked at him. He was locked in a table, and they kept asking him questions. We rented an Israeli car. I arrived at the gate of Gaza. There was an old man at the gate. It was like a gate. I told them, I come from Chile. How can I not know Gaza? Understand me. At least I want to be able to say that I have visited Gaza. I said, open the door for me. And I slipped my head inside. I took a look and left. Believe me, Daniel, he aimed at me with his gun. He said he wanted to make sure I do not enter Gaza.
What language did you communicate in?
In Spanish.
Why? Where did they come from?
An Argentinian was talking to me. Well, I burst out, please.
It is interesting that those who were born in Argentina, their parents were born in Argentina, their grandparents were born in Argentina, their great-great-grandparents were born in Argentina.
And he has more right to be in that land than me, while my father comes from Palestine. In fact, I deserve to be there 1,000 times more. What strikes me so many times, dear Daniel, is that how the only country created by the United Nations, the only country in the world created by the United Nations, is the one that has most often violated the international laws.
These days you have talked with Javier, with your son. What does it tell you about the current situation?
It was very difficult. Lately, tremendously difficult. People are dying. It's brutal. Please, the people have always talked about what the Gaza Strip is. Let's not forget that Palestine is one united country. It is both the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And the West Bank also witnessed death every day.
In addition, they have imprisoned about 3,000, 4,000 people without any prior trial on an administrative basis.
But that's always happens.
But I also understand that almost 80% of the jobs in Palestine disappeared due to everything that this conflict has meant, not only for Palestine, but for the entire world.
But also, Daniel, let's not forget that the largest employer in Palestine is the state. If there are no jobs in Palestine, how can the largest employer, the state, support its people? The state of Palestine has to provide jobs for the people. I remember that my son, who is also very fond of soccer, told me that the only possibility for me to return to Chile is if they offer me a position in the Palestino soccer club. That's because he has strong feelings for Palestine. And they did. They offered him. They called him once and offered him to be the general manager of Palestino.
And he said no.
He said no.
I know him and the commitment he has towards not only Palestine, but also the right of return. This right is a universal, inalienable right, and many have forgotten that it is part of what is being discussed today in this genocide. That's because what Israel intends to do is to displace 2 million people who have already been proposed a territory other than the original one where they used to live.
a 2 millones de personas y ha propuesto.
But Daniel, everyone has said the same thing. With peace of mind, they simply say, let them go to Congo, let them leave.
And the international community has said nothing. Under these conditions, hasn't Javier thought about returning either?
Javier es de Palestina, Daniel.
No, Javier is from Palestine, Daniel. Javier is from Palestine. In fact, he's Palestinian today. He's there because he wants to make his homeland in Palestine, and he's happy in Palestine. Despite the current conditions and the atrocities, they want their land back.
Amén de las condiciones.
This nation acts quite contrary to those who are escaping to their countries of origin today, because they feel insecure in a regime that had promised them security and peace. Well, I thank you very much, César, for this conversation. It has been very constructive, and I hope that we can continue to communicate and talk about Palestine.
Perfect.
Perfecto.
We are imposing a total siege on Gaza. There will be no electricity, no food, no water, no fuel. Everything will be closed. We are fighting animals and we are acting accordingly. The fishermen in Gaza are experiencing a true and terrible catastrophe in the northern and southern areas. Fishing has become an impossible activity. We are only allowed to fish within a space of 6 nautical miles in the western area. We risk our lives to work because Israel's naval ships attack us. Even then we are within the fishing zones, they monitor us with special screens. We could be shot, kidnapped, or injured within 5 minutes, and we can be arrested for up to 3 or 5 years. As you can see, there is not a single person in the fishing port.
We have just watched 2 videos, one very topical, with the Israeli war minister talking about a strategy to annihilate the Palestinian people in Gaza through a total blockade. We're cutting off water, electricity, preventing any economic activity, and any entry of humanitarian aid becomes a tool for the objective of exterminating the Palestinian people, with the excuse of confronting an alleged armed faction of the Palestinian resistance. The other video is a video from 2015 of a fisherman who at that time was already denouncing the blockade and the entire policy of preventing economic activity in the territory of Gaza in such a way as to deepen the forced dependence of the Palestinian economy on the Israeli economy, which was effectively ratified by a report from the United Nations Conference on Development and Trade in 2020. Analyzing a period of 11 years, it came to determine that the blockade of Israel, similar to what happens with Cuba, which is a collective punishment, which is an illegal action in every possible way, one can understand why only when the blockade of Cuba is voted in the United Nations, the United States and Israel are the only countries that support it. And it is for a fundamental reason. It is a tool that they are using in Gaza simply to do the same thing they do with Cuba, with the Palestinian people. How does it work? Stifle the economy, prevent the emergence of the historical activities of the Palestinian territory, which are agriculture, livestock, fishing, and also small-scale manufacturing, small weaving industries, and others, which have been disappearing with a strategy that starts from preventing this country of raw materials, preventing exports, but also separating the Palestinians from the territories that are completely isolated and impossible to connect with each other in such a way that the scales of production are incompatible with the scale of trade that they themselves possess. According to the United Nations, already in 2020, 80% of the Palestinian population depended directly or indirectly on foreign aid. Humanitarian aid and unemployment had risen to close to 30% in all of Palestine, and in the case of Gaza, it was close to 50%, with much higher levels in the segment of young people and women. What is the objective of this? Not only forced displacement, but also the creation of a manipulated market, cheap labor for the Israeli economy, which is the main economy where Palestinians, who do not have opportunities to develop activities in their own territory, have to go to work for paying and receiving poverty wages, hunger wages, really. The Israeli Minister of Tourism declared a few weeks ago that the Palestinians had 3 possibilities, either to all leave Palestine or to stay and work as slaves or to be exterminated. Nothing more eloquent and, by confession, a relief of evidence. Now let's go to the questions from the audience. I don't know if any of you want to ask. We have space for 2 questions. I offer you the floor.
Hola, Daniel. Nicolás Romero, soy director del medio Revista de Frente. Hello, Daniel. I'm Nicolas Romero. I'm director of the magazine Revista de Frente, and I have been listening very carefully to the program, to everything it tells us. And I wanted to ask you about something that you already mentioned about the Palestinian economy. How it is structured, what its branches are, also if there are linked economic institutions to the Palestinian state, if there are banks, etc. And I wanted to ask you how all of this has been affected following what happened in the October of last year, and ultimately, how the Palestinian population, both in Gaza and the West Bank, is currently resisting this entire economic attack. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Nicholas, for your question. Welcome to the program, too. Thank you for being here with us. Indeed, today we are perhaps experiencing the last step, that is, the last chapter, the last link of a policy of economic extermination that has been going on for decades. In fact, the Palestinian economy has no right to have currency. It does not have the right to have its own currency, which is already an absolute limit, because it can only operate directly with checks, which is the Israeli economy, which generates a dependence on the entire monetary policy of the occupying power, or in Jordanian money, which also has difficulties circulating. Until very recently, there was no Palestinian banking. There were some Arab banks with Israeli permission to operate in the occupied territories, but today a Palestinian bank has begun to emerge, but absolutely incipient, which still fails to respond even to the credit needs, let alone with the leverage needs of the industry or small Palestinian commerce. In addition, there are other obstacles, such as the fact that all tax collection is done by the occupying power, and the occupying power withholds the money from the Palestinians when it wants and how much it wants, sometimes even affecting the money that has to reach the Palestinian local governments, which are those directly involved in solving the direct, most pressing and daily problems of Palestinian population. They also limit access to those resources, including humanitarian aid, to the central government, to the Palestinian National Authority. There is a permanent and systematic weakening that has been destroying everything for Palestinians. With honorable exceptions, there are some cities that still manage to survive, for example, from tourism, as is the case of the Bethlehem conurbation due to the great tourism activity, especially Christian, that comes to the area throughout the year, and especially in situations like Easter or Christmas and other holidays. There is a niche that allows subsistence, but absolutely controlled. A clear example, tour guides have to have permission to operate from Israel, and Palestinian tour guides do not have permission to enter Israel, and therefore, anyone who arrives and departs on a tourist trip from Israel, the Israeli tour guide is the one who takes it to all of Palestine, not being able to do the same the other way around. There is an indirect control and an attempt for absolute subordination of the Palestinian economy with these two objectives. There is also an attempt to help usurpers finance their regime. This policy, in fact, reduces the possibility of the Israelis losing this captive market of slaves who work for almost nothing, forced by illegal military occupation.
Obligados por la ocupación militar ilegal.
Hola, Daniel. Soy Lorena Busman.
Hello, Daniel. I'm Lorena Busman. I want to ask you a question. Is there any direct relationship between extreme poverty in Palestine and the wealthy classes in Israel?
Ricas de Israel.
Indeed, there is, like everything else. If there were no poverty, there could be no wealth. Wealth is generated by paying workers less than what their work is worth, and in some conditions, such as in the case of domestic care work, never paying the value of a work that is done every day and that sustains the entire society. In the case of occupied Palestine, there is the captive market with low-priced slaves that allow Israel to have a competitive industry. This market receives more than $3.8 billion annually from Israeli military aid. But it is an aid that, being military, activates the entire economy, and therefore we have an Israeli industry that is capable of working with much higher profits than the rest of the world, solely and exclusively because it has a forced precariousness of the labor market. Its main asset is this captive market for cheap slaves who are in fact the Palestinians of the occupied territories.
Thank you.
benefit is bad news. The absolute complicity and financing that the United States and Europe give to Israel to commit this brutal genocide are beginning to be opposed by the people of the world, who are rising up in all latitudes to represent not only their discomfort, but also their indignation over this genocide, and make an urgent call for a ceasefire and to stop this monstrosity of the international community called Israel. Along with this, numerous union organizations from around the world begin to rise in various ports around the world to prevent 90% of the imports that Israel receives, which are by sea, even managing to stop the import of weapons during this crisis. Notable examples are Yemen, which has decided at its own risk to prevent the passage of all Israeli-flagged ships or companies that trade with Israel and bring supplies to Israel until the blockade of Gaza is lifted. 30% of the ships that arrive in Israel, of this 90% of imports, pass through the Red Sea, and today they are adding an incredible amount, not only of additional days to the journey, but also a cost that is undermining not only the Israeli economy, but the economy of all the countries involved. Parallel to this, Malaysia has also taken measures to boycott Israel. The boycott, divest, and sanction movement is making a global call not to consume products from companies that directly or indirectly finance this genocide through their businesses. Here we have an image of the companies that are involved. Some notable ones are missing, such as Starbucks Coffee, and therefore we are making a call to the world because we have a fresh image of how the boycott of the Africans played a fundamental role in dismantling this black page in the history of humanity. I thank you all for your presence today in this program, and don't miss our next episode. Thank you very much.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
As expected, the Gaza ceasefire resolution has got the world abuzz, while the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has welcomed it by thanking the UN Security Council. The Zionist regime is deeply unhappy and distressed. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote in its statement, Hamas has called for a permanent ceasefire that leads to the withdrawal of all Zionist forces from the Gaza Strip and the return of the displaced to the homes from which they left. To demonstrate its commitment to comply with the resolution, Hamas said it is willing to engage in an immediate prisoner exchange process that leads to the release of prisoners on both sides. In addition, Hamas has called on the UN Security Council to pressure the occupation to adhere to the ceasefire and stop the war of genocide and ethnic cleansing against our people. On the other hand, the war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu is fuming. His anger is reflective of the deep-seated, vengeful characteristic of the racist Zionist ideology, responsible for the mass slaughter of Palestinians in what has outraged the world since October 7th last year. The death toll in the besieged Gaza Strip now tops 32,475% of them children and women, according to the Gaza Media Office. At least 7,000 others are still trapped under the rubble. As the minutes were ticking at the UN Security Council, with member states seeing huddling in groups before the session commenced, Netanyahu issued an ultimatum to US President Joe Biden. If you fail to veto it, I will cancel the trip of my envoys to you. His threat failed this Mali. The Biden administration, which has militarily and financially supported the Israeli regime genocidal war on Gaza in the past 6 months, abstained from voting. Importantly, the U.S. vetoed Gaza ceasefire resolutions on three occasions in 3 months. By not exercising its veto power this time, the resolution sailed through with the support of all 14 states. The much-awaited resolution demands an immediate ceasefire for the holy month of Ramadan. It also calls for an immediate release of hostages without conditioning it. In other words, the resolution does not insist that for the ceasefire to kick in, Israeli regime captives have to be released as prior condition by the Gaza-based Hamas resistance group. Pertinently, the Security Council did not entertain the request submitted by the Russian representative who called for a permanent ceasefire after the holy month of Ramadan. Also, the draft did not accept the demand of the Israeli regime, the US and the UK, to condemn the Hamas resistance group, which irked the Zionist regime and its Western backers, in contextualizing the legal obligations of member states to abide by UNSC resolutions. It's important to distinguish Hamas as a non-state resistance movement engaged in a freedom struggle that is not a party to the UN Charter, whereas the apartheid regime of Israel is. It means that the resolution is primarily directed at the Zionist entity by calling on it as a party to the UN Charter to comply with the ceasefire demand. Also, although the enforcement mechanism isn't clearly defined, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, in his remarks recently, said the much-awaited resolution must be implemented and that failure would be unforgivable. Hence, Hamas is perfectly correct to insist that the UNSC pressures the occupying regime to adhere to the ceasefire resolution and stop the war of genocide and ethnic cleansing against Palestinians. At the same time, while Netanyahu has been throwing tantrums, his military affairs minister, Yoav Gallant, is currently stationed in Washington meeting U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The tension and policy differences between Netanyahu and Gallant have become messy and publicly known, even though the regime has been trying to cover it up to avoid further embarrassment. A crisis between the two warlords, as well as huge cracks in the U.S.-Israel alliance, is a welcome development for Palestine resistance movements, particularly Hamas, notwithstanding the fact that the Biden administration remains fully committed to Netanyahu's criminal goals in Gaza. In his response, on behalf of the Palestinian National Initiative, PNI, Secretary General Mostafa Barghouti was pretty forthright. The UN Security Council resolution for an immediate ceasefire is binding, and it dealt a blow to Netanyahu and his extremist and aggressive government, and sanctions must be imposed on it if it refuses to implement it, he stated. Adding, although the decision was unbalanced with regard to the prisoners because it did not explicitly refer to the need to release thousands of Palestinian prisoners, it stressed the necessity of removing all Israeli obstacles to the arrival of humanitarian aid to all areas of the Gaza Strip, which means the freedom for all displaced persons to return to their homes and areas where they abandoned it. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh, on his visit to Tehran recently a day after the resolution was adopted, said it was delayed and riddled with shortcomings,